This is an interview with Emma LaRocque, recorded in Regina, Saskatchewan, on December the 7th, 1990. This is an interview with Emma LaRocque, recorded in Regina, December 8th, 1990.
Do they have this in poor quality paper now? Have you ever seen the original?
No, no.
Very nice. This is really recycled paper.
Oh, I see.
You got the cheap end there.
I'll just let this run, and if there's ever anything that you think you don't want to be on the tape or so, you just press any of those keys in it.
Well, I'm so sleepy, heaven knows what I'll say.
I thought, I think I told you about the project, what the book is going to be. Interviews with native authors and critics in Canada, and there'll be about 20 of you. And you'll be in very good company, I hope. And one thing that I've asked most of the other writers too is, what made them, how they started writing. And in this book, you've explained that I think you were about 8 years old or so, and you decided you knew that you wanted to be a writer. You were still in school.
Well, I was in grade eight.
Grade eight. Mm-hmm. It was something with eight.
Yeah.
So why, what made you become a writer and a critic like that?
Well, it's hard to tell. As soon as I knew what writing was, I wanted to do it. And mostly I think it came from a profound need to self-express.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was so much in our lives that I quickly learned was not at all being presented.
Mm-hmm.
Either totally neglected or totally distorted. And I think I just had this almost missionary zeal to tell about our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
because Indianness was so dehumanized.
Mm-hmm.
and Métisness didn't even exist, so. Mm-hmm. I guess partly it was that, and partly I come from a background of beautiful oral literature, and both my grandmother and my mother were fantastic storytellers, and I think somewhere that influenced me.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to tell a story.
Yeah.
and just the energy and the art and the creation that goes with that.
Mm-hmm.
And since I couldn't be an actress or actor, though I contemplated being a playwright somewhere along the
mm-hmm.
way, writing just came. How I got to be a bit of a critical writer, I guess, is in a way it comes from a place of protest.
Sure.
About our conditions, about the need for our liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of protesting, you have to become a critic. And but I also became interested in literary criticism proper. And then I got derailed into history.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't had as much time as I would like to study further literary criticism proper. You know, I just kind of do it. But
mm-hmm.
it isn't the field in which I am highly trained.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, being a historian interested in historiography also
sure,
makes
yeah.
me a critic.
Yeah.
In poetry, I'm not sure I consider myself a poet. I just, I put down words and try and put them into a vertebrae form, as I
mm-hmm.
say, and then
mm-hmm.
it looks like a poem. But the eternal question,
like
what is a poem?
I realize that in some of your poems there are lots of alliterations.
Uh-huh.
And I really go for that. I like alliterations myself a lot. And sometimes there's even rhyme, or this one that I thought was so beautiful, the connection of lover and mother sounds similar. And the warmth, the love comes through very much, I think, in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope there will be more poetry by Amala Rock in the future.
Yes, I'm sure, well, there is. In writing The Circle, I refer to doing, hopefully in one volume, my Ama poems,
mm-hmm.
my mom poems,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Hardly had I finished saying that, then my dad died, and just recently, and as I said to somebody, well, I guess now I have to write Bapa poems.
That's in your poems, they come out, yeah. out of a lot of pain and or sadness.
We were very close to, my family is very close in the oddest sort of way,
mm-hmm.
that no matter the distance I went, both in terms of miles and in terms of culture,
mm-hmm.
there was always this, and maybe just because of that distance, there was always this deepening of emotional connection to
mm-hmm.
my family.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents especially, because they represent a way of life that we will never see again.
Yeah.
And there was something, it's not in writing The Circle, by the way, there's another book that just came out, it's called Living the Changes. And my autobiographical essay is in that one.
Living the Changes?
Right, there is a poem there about my mom.
Is that your book?
No, it's edited by Joan Turner. I just contribute
Joan
an
Turner.
Essay.
Mm-hmm. And that came out? Where?
It's just coming out this week from U of M Press. And,
oh, yeah.
There I start my autobiographical essay with a poem that is called Where Did She Go?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story of my mom how I remember her as a child and then how she got assailed by cancer. And as I keep writing this, and suddenly it comes out that what the significance of her death was not only that I lost a mother, but also that she represented, you know, my language, my original culture, and something about the nuance of that is gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where too the pain of losing older people
mm-hmm.
is coming from. Because it's like you've gone through so much bombardment,
yeah.
and disturbance. Then you're just growing up and you're just beginning to pick up the pieces and understand this and understand that, and you're just beginning to come home. And then, you know, the damn death comes and swipes you one more time,
yeah.
in a very final way.
Yeah.
And then it's like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where a lot of the pain comes from.
Mm.
But there's no way you can escape pain being native in this country, but also being human.
Yeah.
And I've always tried. That's why I'm, you know, writing, being a historian and working with footnotes and all that is one thing. And sometimes I enjoy it. But just maybe there's a part of me that also needs to go into something like
sure.
creativity, such as writing poetry, just to keep me sane and remind me who I am,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
How, your Ama and your Mokom, I guess they spoke in Cree?
Yes.
Do you, when you meet people from your families or other relatives, so you speak Cree?
I speak Cree. I don't speak as well as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
Words don't come like that.
Oh, I see.
Anymore. Mm-hmm. I sometimes have to think many, many minutes. But that's the other loss I felt when my mom died.
Mm-hmm.
Was my mom always anticipated what word I was needing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm conversing with her and I'm,
mm-hmm.
she'd say it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, you know, she was my teacher.
Yeah.
As we went along. My dad wasn't as quick about providing words, but he was getting pretty good. If I'm around him,
mm-hmm.
I was around him long enough. But so there's that loss too. But yeah, all my family except my nieces and nephews speak Cree.
Mm-hmm.
And my brothers and sisters, and you know, when the, a few weeks ago we were at a, of course, we had a wake
yeah.
for my father. And oh my goodness, I never knew I had so many relatives.
mm-hmm.
And they were just rocking the place. And I left, you know, when I was 14. And half the people I didn't recognize, but I had heard names in Cree of who they
mm-hmm.
were. And it was, you know, if one could say this during one's father's funeral, it was as healing a wake and as a very traditionally Métis wake as I've ever experienced since I was a child. And it was wonderful because one of the beauties of it was that I heard Cree
yeah.
all night from every corner of the house. It was just, you know, and I thought, wow, we're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that part was wonderful. And of course, my mom's three sisters were there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just as animated storytellers mm-hmm. as my mom used to be. And it was just so healing
mm-hmm.
to hear them tell stories. And, you know, it reminded me of my mom. And also they were filling me in on details I never knew
mm-hmm.
about my parents. And all in Cree. Almost all of it in Cree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just mixed it with a few little English words here and there. And
mm-hmm. What about French?
Creeified them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our Cree is inherently peppered
mm-hmm.
with l'eau.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
That's almost the extent of
mm-hmm.
the French. My dad used to speak a lot of nuts. He said a lot of words in French.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know they were French until I took French in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came home and... You know, and my dad is saying his French things, and I said, Baba, that's French. And he looked at me like, yes. And so it is. It has always been. Thing, you know. Well, then why didn't you tell me? Never asked. But emotionally, we were very Métis.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to understand that Western, and particularly Northern Métis-ness, does not identify emotionally with the French.
No, no.
We are very Cree.
Yeah.
I think the French part assimilated into the Cree part in the movement from 1870s to the 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
That exile from the
yeah,
Red River.
Yeah.
And so we're very Cree. But when I went back to Winnipeg, and I say back because in a way for me it was going back.
Mm.
But I didn't even know it.
Yeah,
I didn't even know it until
mm-hmm.
I was there and started. But I met French Métis.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very different.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a while to accept them as Métis. And I think it took them a while to accept
mm-hmm.
me as Métis. But there are definitely differences also among the Métis.
Oh, sure. Yeah. When you write poetry, and if you compare that to Cree, or when you talk about your grandmother and your mother talking in Cree and being such wonderful storytellers, now you write in English. Is that essentially something very different, or is there a disruption, or do you wish you could use both, or how is that relationship?
Well, it isn't difficult for me. But what I wish is that other people understood Cree so that I could use it more freely
mm-hmm.
in all my writing and without having to put it in brackets and explain what it
yeah.
means. You know,
yeah.
so as
yeah.
I said in Writing the Circle, it's quite distracting.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you want to, and especially in poetry, you want to do soul, what is
mm-hmm.
popularly known as soul language.
Mm-hmm.
And but for myself, I've never felt that there was a hopeless disruption.
Mm-hmm.
I've just, you know, my parents, I mean, my whole life was Cree. It's very animated, very, very passionate.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a part in English where you can get that.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I don't believe in literally translating oral Cree literature, for example. If we're
mm.
telling Wasakhecha stories, you know,
yeah.
you cannot literally translate them in
no.
English, you kill them.
Yeah.
So what I do when I teach, say, one of my circulate in Native literature, and we are in the part about original language, what I do is I retell, say, a Wasagatcha story in an English that will be appealing.
Yeah.
It's nothing like the literal original.
No.
But it's a lot like the spirit and the passion of the original telling. Because
mm-hmm.
I've seen how literal translations, the net effect of that is it infantilizes
mm-hmm.
Native oral literatures. And also,
how does it infantilize?
Well, it makes it look like grade one, grade two stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know how in grade one and grade two.
Is that because the grammar is different?
Tom, Dick, and Jane went to school.
Yeah.
Okay, so you try and tell a story about Wasagatcha. Well, Wasagatcha was walking down the lane and he met a fox.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Cree. Ah, Wasagatcha said, "Be mo tete se we wap mate so ya ya." Now, see, I forget the word fox.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're off.
Mm-hmm.
And you get all the nuances, and you can just see what's going on. You
it's
know,
very musical language. Huh?
I don't know. I've never heard it from the others.
Yeah.
But I hope so. It
yeah.
certainly sounds lovely to me.
Yeah, it does. I was thinking, also some other Métis authors who use both languages, English and maybe some Cree, some French, that Métis culture was incorporating various different cultures also linguistically. And if I think of Chicanas and Chicanos writing, who sort of write in Spanglish or combine Spanish and Mexican and Nahuatl and English and whatever, this could become almost a distinctive trait of Métis literature, that authors would be able to sort of move freely and incorporate, you said, soul language, certain parts of say, Cree and so. Have you ever thought about that or experimenting with that?
It's a good concept. And of course, you're familiar with some linguistic work on the Michif
mm-hmm.
language. And the controversy whether it is a language or or the pidginization of two languages. That would be difficult to do in written form
uh-huh.
for me.
Oh,
and I'm not
but
sure
you
why.
If you use your Nokom and Ama.
Oh, I use the Cree,
yeah,
but
yeah,
I don't mix the Cree in you know, like I wouldn't do
You mean a mixed sentence?
Well, like you say, Spanglish.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't do a...
No, but that's what Chicanas and Chicanos do, too.
A Creeglish.
No, it's...
But
it's
I couldn't, I can
whenever something is close to your heart and to your experience,
you
use the appropriate term.
You have to.
And if you say Ama, it's something different from saying mother.
Exactly.
And that's why you use that.
Yeah.
And that also for an outsider marks, okay, this very private, this loving warmth experience from childhood and the love can only be expressed in that language because that is part of that culture. So.
Oh, yes. And what I hope is that there will be enough of us writers soon
mm-hmm.
using Cree or whatever other Aboriginal language so that non-native critics can begin to even develop a vocabulary
mm-hmm.
that they can become familiar with. But there's also another difficulty, and that is that Cree, there is no standard form
of
writing Cree in English.
Except for the syllabic, I think that's probably.
Right,
mm-hmm.
but
yeah.
even I don't know syllabics.
Mm-hmm.
My mom did. My mom
mm-hmm.
my mom was literate in syllabics.
Oh, yeah.
And,
I think Cree, of the Indian languages, it's probably the one that has the greatest chance of being a literate language, seeing more literature in Cree. I know that some things are coming out in Cree. I know even Thompson Highway's book is supposed to come out in Cree, The Rare Sisters.
I just hope there's enough people who know the syllabic system so they can read it.
No, it's. I don't think it'll be in the syllabic, or they'll be doing it in both. I'm not sure about that. And the only parallel I could think of is inuktitut, right? Those things that come out Inuit, mm-hmm. and with an English translation, with a syllabic, and with the Roman. And I think that would be an interesting project, because it marks here mm-hmm. there are these different forms.
Oh, I hope it comes to pass.
Yeah. You said something in, I think it was in the introduction here, sort of the dilemma that native writers can be caught in. On the one hand, you need all the energy and all the support to put the native literature out there so it's visible, because mm-hmm. it's there and it's very beautiful and rich. On the other hand, if the term is tagged onto it, this is native literature, there's also the danger of ghettoization, of saying, okay, this is native literature, mm-hmm. something mm-hmm. that sort of is kept mm-hmm. in its place, mm-hmm. in quote. Mm-hmm. How do you resolve that dilemma? Historically?
I think only the native writers themselves cannot resolve this dilemma on their own. The mainstream intellectuals and critics, the two not being mutually exclusive, they are going to have to start taking our writing seriously.
Oh yeah.
And when they do, and we can begin to dialogue, mm-hmm. and not stay marginalized,
yeah.
and yet we can still retain pride in the fact that this is native literature. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we can resolve it that way, because the loneliness now and the dilemma now the dilemma now is the loneliness of not being taken seriously, and the loneliness of not being understood,
mm-hmm.
simply because white Canadians are abysmally ignorant.
That's true.
Of Aboriginal peoples. And I don't mean that as an insult, I mean
it's a historical
fact.
Yeah.
And so you're forever having to explain before you can even begin to dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of energies being derailed and drained that way.
Yeah.
And, so you're lonely from that aspect of it. You're also lonely because there is no large native audience.
No.
And again, because of the education, and there is, virtually a non-existent native audience. So one feels isolated sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I mm-hmm. should also maybe answer just one mm-hmm. more question, then we can go. We can pick this up in Winnipeg too,
I would like to. Also because you teach mm-hmm. native literature, and I'd like to ask you which text you would include.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you said, I like that the dilemma is, it's not just a native dilemma, it's much more, I think, a dilemma of the mainstream. And I absolutely agree with you. But I tell you, we're working on it.
Yes.
I say I.
Yeah, I know you certainly have, but of course you have to come from Germany and teach Canadians.
When people say, why do you do this? I say, well, because there were 40 applicants and they didn't find the right one. You see?
Yeah.
I mean, that tells you something about... I lectured at the English department here, and there was no way they knew it. I did the same at a conference in No, here I am talking, sorry.
I'm a little sleepy, so I don't know what kind of scintillating interview I can give.
So, I got up at 3, according to this time. I went to bed at 10, but then there were people partying, and I didn't go to sleep until 2, so...
You were at a conference?
No, I flew out to...
Okay.
I went to Escassoni, that's Cape Breton Island, to interview Rita Joe.
Oh!
You see? So the first night I stayed at her house, and then I had to stay another night and then leave really early in the morning, and there was no way of getting from the reserve to Sydney, to the airport, so I went to Sydney in the afternoon and went into a hotel.
So you could have come to Winnipeg to interview me.
No, yeah, sure. But the trip that I got was, the publisher got the ticket, and it's like a cheap deal. And I didn't know the exact ticket. No, I did know by the time that we had that interview, because they told me that I would have quite a few hours on the way back in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I saw this. Yeah. They paid me one trip to Vancouver and one out east.
That's good.
To Thunder Bay, stopping over in Toronto, I met with...
And actually, they've reprinted it many times without ever letting me know.
Oh, that was Defeathering the...
Yeah,
when
yeah.
did that first come out?
75.
And the edition that I have, the recent one, did you get any royalties on that
No.
one? No.
No? No extra ones. I get
8%
royalties.
Oh, that's not much.
No,
I was told
it translates to about $90 a year. The last few years.
Wow.
Yeah, so. People, there is a misguided notion that I am well off, and actually I have no business sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an artist. And I'm poor.
Yeah. No, I'm not poor, but I have no business sense.
Yeah.
At least I'm not poor this year, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, I'm poor, well, because of my sabbatical, I'm poor this year. All right, let's get going.
Yeah, I talking about Defeathering the Indian. I read that book a couple of years ago.
Is this on?
Yes, this is on. It should be, yeah. It's blinking away, yeah. I read that a couple of years ago, and you know that I worked on similar issues myself, although mostly in German. And I really liked your book. Yet, I felt you're too hard on the case of Margaret Lawrence, because you say, "Oh, this was my reaction." I haven't read that much maybe Canadian literature, but I always thought that she's very perceptive.
Do I say anything about Margaret Lawrence and Defeathering?
Is it
no.
Defeathering or is
no,
it in
no,
the article?
It's an article you
it's
read
article.
On the Métis and Canadian literature.
That's right. That's the one. That's right. That's right.
No, I thought I was very generous with Margaret Lawrence.
Yeah, you said she did a, it was a nice try, but still it was the old noble savage imagery.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I think she is the most perceptive writer Canada has.
Yeah, exactly.
And she perceived a lot about Métis people.
Mm-hmm.
And I especially liked her... With each novel, the Tonnerre family,
they
are on the fringes
of society,
and they get closer and closer
exactly.
till literally, you know, it gets into her, sexually speaking, and every other way. And but in the end, I did feel that she did play... I mean, just this is relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite mild compared to other writers.
Yeah.
But I do think that in the end there was some... yes, like, you know, the Métis man, Jules.
Yeah.
He had to die nobly, kind of thing. That kind of, I thought... And he played some stereotypical roles. But I think the larger point I was making there was we have yet to have a novel, a great novel, by a native writer that would catch the nuances of the ethos of being Métis, particularly in my case, or generally of being native. And that's all I was saying there.
Yeah, that's true. I agree on that. Did you, in Bird in the House, there's this one short story, Cry of the Loons, where, what's her name? Vanessa, I guess, huh? Which is Margaret Lawrence, as far as I can see. She's up at the cottage, and they have one of the Tenier girls, Piquette Tenier, who had who's got a limp, and it's not healing very well. The father, Vanessa's father, is a doctor, and they take her along for so she can recuperate. And all of a sudden, this non-native girl, Vanessa, realizes she's been fed on stereotypes, on Longfellow and all these things. And all of a sudden, she realizes, hey, this is a native person. She was raised on lofty notions about Hiawatha and Hiawatha mm-hmm. and so on. And she realizes, this is probably as close as I might ever get to a native person. And she's sort of intrigued to know more from Piquette about the lore of the woods and all this. And of course Piquette can't respond to that. She responds, what do you think? And she wasn't interested in the stereotype. And then I found the most perceptive passage I've ever found in non-native literature about somebody realizing how the stereotype sort of superimposes itself in front before you can actually meet people. And I always give credit for that.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
My lifetime experience.
Yeah. If you were, I know you teach native literature. You said there's still the novel to come that sort of treats native people from their own perspective. Can you think of any novels that you think come close to that, or that may be on the way?
not a novel. I would say some recent plays have mm-hmm. come a little closer.
Which ones, for example?
Well, mostly I'm thinking of Thompson Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of his plays, The Rez Sisters and mm-hmm. the other one.
Dry Lips?
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I'm still waiting for that novel.
Mm-hmm.
I had a student a number of years ago in my class, in Canadian Native Lit class.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's going to write that novel. He now works with Pemmican Publications.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been after him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a brilliant. I think he's a brilliant writer. Off the record, his name is...
Do you want me to put this out?
Yeah, just...
what about you writing that novel? You ever tried that?
No, I'm not sure I could... I used to, when I was younger and had energy and was less jaded than I am now. But I like plays more.
Mm-hmm.
I puttered around more with plays or with short stories.
Oh, yeah.
And my poetry, which is really, I think, I would call my poetry the I don't want to say prosaic poetry, but it's more narrative type of
mm-hmm,
poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't quite decided what I think of it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that I would ever write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would have to be very rested, and when you teach,
mm-hmm.
I've found that teaching the last 2 years I've had a leave, but
mm-hmm.
the 12 years of teaching, nonstop. It just does something to you. You feel like you're never done.
Yeah.
You feel
yeah.
like you're running around all the time, and you have all these things you have to finish.
Yeah.
These projects, this book,
mm-hmm.
and I can't write when I'm feeling like there are so many loose ends.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that. And I keep thinking, well, one of these days, I'll organize my files, I'll clean up my desk, I'll have all my lecture notes prepared well ahead of time, and I'll stop going on lecture tours. And then I'll write my great piece of literature. However, I don't think that'll ever come to pass.
No.
But maybe I'll get disgusted with
with
academia yet and just go into writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, some, you know, people have asked me, what would you really like to do with your life the rest of the way?
Mm-hmm.
I really would like to write.
Just write full-time?
Yeah, I really would just write full-time.
Mm-hmm. And write what?
Oh, I think I would write novels. I think I would write way more poetry.
Literature, fiction,
yeah.
Or poetry.
Right,
uh-huh.
Or short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And more criticism. I do like criticism.
But
critical
just
writing.
Go into literature
just
full-time.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, but... I, you know, when I, after I wrote Defending the Indian, I learned you'd starve yourself if you stayed a writer in this country. And so, you know, most writers go into a different kind of work, and they end up writing as because they have to do it, because they love it.
Yeah.
But
they can't live on it.
But they can't live on it, and so they don't do full-time.
I don't think there's... maybe Thompson Highway is the only professional writer in Canada. I don't think any of the others...
Native or non-native?
I mean...
Native.
Native,
yeah.
Professional writer.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, he's director of the, this agency, Native Earth Performing Arts. So I'm sure his income doesn't really come from publications.
No.
I don't think there's any native writer yet in Canada.
How about Maria Campbell?
The way from the times that I've met her, she is always, it's hand-to-mouth projects,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes she's very, very poor and very dire straits, and then she may have an offer which keeps her going. Writing and I guess doing project works or scripts and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that is the bulk of her income where it comes from, I just don't know. Maybe she's close to that. Yeah.
Well, that's a very Canadian way of life too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There's so many people who have to go contract to contract.
Exactly.
And they really do live hand to mouth. And I used to live like that 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that that was too difficult. And that's partly why I... However accidental it was, I ended up teaching and I ended up staying.
Mm-hmm.
And I do, for the most part, enjoy teaching. But you compromise a lot because you have to have money.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, because I just couldn't live this running around from project to project. I think that's very draining.
Yeah.
Mind you, teaching is quite draining too, but at least it's a bit stable. And
mm-hmm. The job gives you security. You know,
mm-hmm. And as soon as I had my leave,
mm-hmm.
you know, I did more literary writing than, as they say, pure research, which I am supposed to do. But I find that I'm much more drawn to writing and critical writing than I am puttering around in with old newspapers in the archives.
Mm-hmm. But you still do that,
I'm allergic to old newspapers in the archives. I truly am. Like.
So you've got to work on microphones.
Yes, and then my eyes can't handle that. So it's quite difficult.
Yeah.
I have to do it fairly slowly.
Are you still working on academic research?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I guess you have to. Huh?
You have to, yes, in order to stay... in order to survive in the university, you have to.
Yeah.
But presently, I have been distracted by family events the last few months. But after Christmas, I'm going back to reading for my PhD exams, which I hope will be next fall.
Oh, yeah. But you've got to finish the thesis first, right?
No, you have to take the exams first.
Oh, I see.
And then you do the thesis.
Oh, I see. Well, I keep my fingers crossed.
Ah, speaking of that, I should say that I think I did something. I have made history, actually many times, all on my own, and it's gone entirely unacknowledged. But this one is worth mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
I got what I wanted for my program. Mm-hmm. But it took a year and a half to negotiate. I am majoring in Aboriginal history at U of M, and it's not in the calendar.
Oh, that's good.
So I felt very good about that, because I felt like, my goodness, you know, I'm 41 years old. I've worked the last 20 years on this history.
Mm.
Why should I now go into something totally new and be 60 years old by the time I get to knowing that area?
Did you have a lot of obstacles to remove?
Well, I guess other people have had more, but I had my share.
Mm-hmm. Mainly in sort of which way? That it didn't fit the established academic structure?
Right, first that it didn't fit the structure, and I had to go, of course, to convince my supervisor, and she wasn't optimistic that it would get passed.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got a committee going, and the committee did, as a whole, I think they helped influence my supervisor to become optimistic, and after a while, you know.
So your supervisor, she a historian?
Yes, actually. Mm-hmm. And again, off the record, she's Jean Friesen.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's a good one.
She's now a member of the legislature here in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
She just got in, and she's very pro-native.
Mm-hmm.
And the other obstacle, which I would like on record, is that I had a colleague that's in the Department of History, and I thought I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we were friends, and I asked him to write a reference, you know, one of these.
Yeah.
And I was in discussion with him many times. I showed him my works,
mm-hmm.
and well, I nearly died what he wrote, and mercifully he had the decency at least to send a copy to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked them to remove it from the files, but it had done its damage. I know for sure that I lost my possibility of getting my my fellowship because of what he wrote. And basically what he wrote, it will be in a forthcoming article from the University of Lethbridge, but you know, the obstacles that all native people go through, but you go through it in on every level, and it comes differently, and in some ways it comes the most insidious and the most horrifying in the higher echelons of Canadian society, including the university. And when people you think were your friends do these things, you know, basically what he wrote was that I was remarkably gifted, but did not apply myself as a scholar or to scholarship, and that my writing was full of, how did he put it? Refers too much to facts of biography.
Too personal.
And then he has mistakenly associated that with, therefore lacks a broad base of theoretical and empirical background. I couldn't believe it. But I, for one, would support, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So I have begun to speak to that kind of, you know, that's intellectual colonization. And he is not originally Canadian, and he thinks that he is therefore not a Canadian colonizer. And but I was astonished with that, you know, and I've started to speak to that. This crap about using facts of biography, that of course depends on the type of work you do. I have my share of academic articles. And when I do use passive biography, it is to humanize the much dehumanized Indian, you know, in the old-fashioned, stereotypical way. And then this assumption that if you do use any facts of biography, that you are therefore parochial, you are therefore narrow, and that you don't have a theoretical or empirical background. I just about, you know, I have read more interdisciplinary material than any colleague of mine I know in Canadian history. And, you know, I have to read psychology, sociology, anthropology, political science, religion, literature, and now women's studies, and now ethnohistory, et cetera, et cetera. Plus I get into creative writing, and Native Studies isn't interdisciplinary studies, you know,
sure.
It's not.
Yeah.
But I'm stuck in a
dissenters, and it's always from a very narrow perspective of what established academia defines as being scholarly. Because if you look at research, especially by in women's studies in the last decade or two, I think the autobiographic or so has made it as a valuable approach, let's put it that way, and to discard that and say it's unscholarly also shows that maybe this person hasn't read all the scholarly stuff that there is.
Well, it showed to me this person hadn't, was quite medieval in his reading, in his theoretical and empirical background.
And it's also a very male perspective.
Right.
Say, this is
right,
it, and we cut out every feeling and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, it's maybe this is going too far, but that's exactly the linear, exclusive approach that has led us to where we are.
Oh, totally, yes.
Yeah.
No, it's, you will be interested in this article. Actually, you'll be interested in this essay, Tides, Towns, and Trains, because it begins to speak to that. But I do so quite a bit more directly in this article called, I entitle it, The Colonization of a Native Woman Scholar. So you asked me about obstacles. That was probably the most painful one.
Yeah.
And the most aggravating one.
Yeah, also on the personal level. Huh?
And, it was very, it was very personal in that I thought he was a friend, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but I was dumb because I should have known way back when he had chosen a male native over me to be in a certain position in Native Studies. Who knows these things? I live and learn. I am ancillaring in women's studies. Because I have read some excellent material. And to me, the most exciting and the most refreshing kind of thinking and creativity, and therefore excellent scholarship coming out right now, is from women's studies and from Native studies. Because we are bringing questions and ideas and substance that the white middle class male hasn't even begun to think of.
Did you read this introductory article that I sent you, that Wolfgang Karrer and I did together on minority literatures in North America?
I perused it. I perused the whole thing. That reminds me, I had a bone to pick about something in there. And that was, I forget the details now, as to who the author was, but it was entitled, I forget what's entitled, but the word squaw is in it. And it was in reference to Native American writers, Native women American writers.
But it was probably put in quote marks, not as a serious term.
Well,
I wouldn't use it as a serious
you,
term.
It wasn't you, it was someone else. No, I know you wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Was it
a quote, huh?
Well, I'm not sure. But I just, like I said, I was perusing it, and it was in reference to Paula Gunn Allen, I think.
Oh, I know what that is. I think I know what that is. It's the title of an article by Elisabeth Herrmann, Academic Squaws.
Right.
I had a long argument with her, and then and I said, I think I would take that out, even if it's a quote. It's a quote from Paula Gunn Allen. No, from I think Wendy Rose. She has a poem, I think, Academic Squaw.
Hmm.
So it's a quote from the title of a poem by a Native woman. But still, personally, I wouldn't have used it for a title, but she said it's okay, and she knows, I think, both the people she's writing about, and she felt it was okay, so I'm not a sort of iron-fisted editor to say you can't do that, and it's in quote marks, but I have the same feeling about that.
I have to go back and read it. I saw the title, I read a few parts of it.
I know what it is. It's you can only have seen that in the photocopy. There's also a table of contents. And in the table of contents, there are the names of the contributors and the titles. And in the title it says that. I don't think it's in our article. Or it's referring to that.
I can
look it up. I can send you the article.
Well, I'm going to look it up again. But I was very offended by that.
Yeah. So would I. And that's what I foresaw. That's why I had an argument with Elisabeth.
I haven't met either Wendy Rose or Paula Gunn Allen, but I would have a stiff chat with them.
I think Wendy Rose uses it quite sort of turning it around.
Well,
the way Howard Adams uses Half Breed. He turns it around.
Well, you get into the question of language.
Yeah, and uses it?
How much is reclaimable?
Yeah.
And to what? You know, to me, there are some words that are not reclaimable, and squaw is one of them. I happen to agree with Howard Adams about half-breed. In fact, I prefer half-breed to Métis, because I feel like Métis is so aristocratic, and and I come from a rough and tumble half-breed background, and we never use the word Métis. Until I came to Manitoba, and some very colonized Métis were highly offended
if you
by
use
the term half-breed. Well, it's all in the way you use it.
Yeah.
So I certainly understand that, and it's like black is beautiful, blah blah blah. But I don't know, squaw.
No, I think there are two things. One is the
I
term
have problems
squaw.
With squaw.
Yeah.
Because of its origin, because of the way it continues to be used, and because I think it reflects an internalization problem, depending on how it is used. I mean, I can use it in a certain way, in a sarcastic way, or in a cynical way, to make a point. But to use it to refer to myself, for example, I would not join a march that would say squaw is beautiful.
No, it wasn't used. We would have to have the text here to really look at it. I wouldn't either.
Yeah.
In that case, if it's referring to that poem, I think it's an ironic inversion in saying here in academia, being Native women and using that term that has been always used to slander, to throw it back. But I think I would still agree with you. First, I personally wouldn't use the term, I think. And secondly, it's also a difference whether Paula Gunn-Allen or Wendy Rose decide for a specific reason to use it, maybe as a political term, to throw back. And it's a different thing for a non-Native to use it.
I think, yeah, there are all those levels.
Yeah.
But it's true, it all depends.
And still, very objectionable term.
I would have to read the original.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then see how it is. But I just saw it as I'm going by, I'm perusing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I went...
I'll look it up again.
And I went, oh, yuck, how tacky.
No, it's okay, yeah.
I mean, not to mention all the other big words we could use about it, but I just thought, oh, how tacky.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess part of me wants really to get away from Hollywood jargon. And even I myself now have second thoughts about using defeathering.
Yeah?
Because... I meant
because
it
assumes that the feathers are there.
But, right. But of course, I was referring to the school curriculum, which assumed that.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's mm-hmm. been misused and misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still in response to the stereotypes. But of course, mm-hmm. in 75, that was still a huge issue. And it still is today, but some things have changed. I think.
You know,
But I get tired of it. I mean, even Beth Brant's Mohawk Trails.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to say, Beth, try something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have problems.
That's a good discussion. Let's check out some other terms like voice. Native voice, northern voices, first people, first voices. It's okay?
No. Depends who wrote it.
Okay. No, I didn't mean the contents, I just meant the term, because that seems to, first there were myths and tales from the smokehouse, from the longhouse, from the igloo, all these tales.
Oh, right, yeah.
Always saying it's oral. Which is true, it was oral. And now voice. Sometimes I think that terms create maybe new cliches are used over again.
Yes. Well, in my essay, in writing The Circle, I actually begin with that we were referred to as voiceless.
Yeah.
And that was a cliche about 5 years ago or so in Canadian literature.
Mm-hmm.
And to be precise, Rudy Weeb gave that cliche. Native people are voiceless. And I remember when I first heard it, and I had quite a reaction to it. And then I go through it fairly systematically, what my reaction was about in the essay. The opposite of voiceless, I guess, is voice. But it certainly can, yes, it certainly,
so you see it as a reaction to saying to the stereotype of voicelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I understand. Well, that's why I was asking, just to expand on. Did I tell you I'd like to call this collection of interviews Contemporary Challenges?
Mm-hmm.
And the subtitle, I haven't made up my mind yet. Either Conversations with Canadian Native Authors or Canadian Native Authors Speak.
I would go for conversations, but I like that word myself.
Yeah, I like it too.
And it's
it too.
One I use in some works.
And about the contemporary challenges?
About contemporary challenges, I should tell you, and I'm sure you know there is a serial book by a sociologist, and he calls his book contemporary conflicts.
Oh.
Well, Fridaires?
No, I... Oh!
J.S. Fridaires.
Yeah, I know the name.
Who thinks he knows everything there is to know about Native people because he married one. But,
Contemporary conflict, it's called.
Yes.
And well, then it this has will a, be contemporary challenges.
And it has a subtitle, Native Peoples of Canada.
Okay. Well, I think I can stick to the challenges. The reason I wanted that title, and so far I've met, I haven't asked all the contributors, because originally what I had in mind was Native Literatures in Canada, and that book has appeared recently, as you know. Actually, it's called Native Literature, not Literatures. Then I thought, it's all the Native literature there is, and it's growing so fast. It's really a challenge to academia, to the established English departments, to actually see what there is and not exclude it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly very much contemporary. That's why I wanted it. I didn't want to look in the past again, all the long tales and all the collections and all the things that have been collected and regurgitated and edited and all that. So that's why, and I'm glad you go for the conversations. But you see, if I use conversations, I come into it more than if it just says talk. Do you understand?
I do, but I
No.
You are part of it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You're very much a part of this discussion.
Yeah.
And I myself think, between you and me, I think there is more integrity in that. Because if I am going to speak myself, I will myself write a book.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
Whereas I see this as a conversation and it's a two-way thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you create it as much as I do. In fact, if you're kind of letting it happen, I see. See,
yeah.
You're very much influencing it then.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So for me, that's how I would do it. But,
I think I might stick with that. I've asked a few people and they said, that's okay, go ahead.
Mm. Because speak is also a bit of a cliche.
Exactly. That's what I was worried about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's the old saying.
Yeah.
Here, my old friends,
yeah,
I've got
exactly,
this message.
Exactly, yes.
And then he goes
right.
It's a ye, of course.
Right. Oh, yes, of course.
Whereas most of the people interviewed here, I think most of them are women.
And notice...
And the most fascinating writing, this is not to insult... No, there are some very good Native male writers, too. But the most, like you said, the most exciting stuff that is being written is by women and by minority women, Native women. I think so.
I'm not sure I said Native women.
You said Native.
I said
women, and I was surprised
about
that.
Women studies and Native people.
Okay. Well, I would
more
say
more inclusive,
it's,
but
okay.
But more Native women are writing now.
Yeah, that's true.
And. Certainly.
Oh, you mean by Native peoples, fourth world peoples, or Aboriginal peoples in general?
No, Canadian.
Mm-hmm. No, I was thinking in the whole term of North America, if you think of black women writing, Asian women writing, Chicanos, and Native women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you read that introductory article, I think that's what it's about, or what it burns down to. You say that somewhere.
In my introductory article?
No, in the one that I gave you for this anthology.
Yeah.
Since we interrupted this interview, I listened to what we've recorded so far, and I think from my side I've asked the things that I need to ask. That I think I need to ask. Now, you may feel quite different, and I'd like you to say what you think you'd like to say and what should appear in that book, or come up with some suggestions.
Yeah, probably when I see it in print, I will I will then revise it, you know, trust me. And this is what academia does to you. You know, I'm a spontaneous and passionate person when I get going.
Mm-hmm.
And I am at my prime
mm-hmm.
when I am engaging. Then when I see what I have said, when I see it in print, I think, oh God, my dean is going to think I've totally gone off the rocket here.
Mm.
And then I will, well, not my dean, but you know, an
mm-hmm.
academic
yeah,
community.
Yeah.
God knows what that is. And then I go, ah, I better tighten up here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I edit myself.
Yeah.
And,
I don't think in this book there should be that much editing. Yeah. If it stays conversations.
Yeah.
What I take out is the obvious, you know, and all that. And then I'll have to shorten it. But in one case, one of the people I interviewed, I said, I don't do any editing. That's what you do. I said, no, I want this to be shared. It's not because I'm lazy. But I don't want to hone it down into something
mm-hmm.
that I think is important.
Yeah.
People should have an input. No? So,
yeah, I was thinking. I was. There was something else that I wanted to add or revise.
Yeah.
There were two things. Now I can't remember one of
mm-hmm.
them. But the one I do remember was... You said my poetry had a lot of pain.
I think I listened to it again and I realized the way you reacted that that you weren't happy with that. I listened to that, yesterday. I think what I meant is that there is a lot of pain or sadness in the background, and I think I had the feeling that partly has stimulated the poetry. I'm not saying that I'm not in the way that I say you're whining about something. I don't mean that at all.
No,
but there's a lot. There's pain
I wasn't even
and suffering in the background. Okay.
No, I think I wanted to add
mm-hmm.
to what I said.
Mm-hmm.
That I didn't take it in the way of
okay.
that I was whining.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes one of the other
mm-hmm.
thousand images associated with Native people is suffering.
That's true.
Is pain.
Yeah.
And what to do when something is true, like it has become a stereotype,
but
in real life, it is really true. And it's all in the way that you see it. It's all in the way that you deal with it. And you can see the same thing. And one person may deal with it in a very racist and stereotypical way, and another person will deal with it in a very authentic and hopefully compassionate way.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are Native, of course, most of us, I would venture to say, have gone through a tremendous amount of suffering. And in my autobiographical essay, you'll see more of it, more references to how the suffering has been. So there is that. There is no two ways about it. But I also wanted to say, I think one of the things I used to have, it's lessening a little bit, and it could be because I'm getting older or because things really have changed. Sometimes I can't decide. But I have always wanted to show the multifaceted aspect of myself,
mm-hmm.
of my family, of my community, of Aboriginal people in Canada. And so I just wanted to say some of my poetry is also whimsical and playful.
Oh yes, oh yes.
But interestingly, I have had problems getting that kind of poetry published because
it doesn't fit, huh?
It doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like I said in writing The Circle in the preface, some of my poetry has been returned because it wasn't, quote, Indian enough.
Yeah.
And part of that is that it wasn't tragic enough. I've submitted a lovely poem about hoarfrost, for example, or playing with my dad's boots
mm-hmm.
in the winter and trying to fit into his boots and squeaking around in the
mm-hmm.
snow and the moonlight. And a very
poignant and sharp memory, mm-hmm. which really happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it had lots of nuances for mm-hmm. me. It had lots of meaning. And that those poems have been rejected over and over again. Now, they could be bad poems. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I may need to revise them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's because white publishers and editors want, you know, native language in, put into the, you know, I'll throw a Cree word in, then maybe they'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they want tragedy. So I myself, as a personality, is a very animated person who mm-hmm. laughs very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I love life for the mm-hmm. most part.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, believe me, I've had my share of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't be here if I hadn't been able to be multifaceted.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an urgency to get that across. That's partly why I want to be a poet as well as a scholar.
Yeah.
That's the other obstacle I get. People think if I write poetry or literature mm-hmm. proper, then I really must not be a proper scholar.
That is weird. People
and
in Canada should
around.
Say that, because that so often is the case. If you look at people writing literature, usually they are affiliated with some English department. Maybe the problem is that you're in with a history.
Right. Exactly.
If you yes. were in an English department, it would mm-hmm. be no problem.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And
you're almost
yes.
expected.
Yes.
But,
we live with many anomalies as native people, as scholars, actually, for that matter. And that's one of them, yes. It's the problem with disciplines.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but yeah, so that's what I wanted to add about pain in my writing.
I'm glad you bring that up, because I realized you sort of jolted when I said that, and it's not true. And your explanation that those texts were rejected
mm-hmm.
doesn't surprise me. And when you were talking right now, there were two things that I wanted to just mention. I think quite a few native writers are reacting exactly to the expectation that their text must be sad, because there is so much sadness.
Right.
And they refuse. I don't know whether you've read Ruby Slipperjack's Honor the Sun.
Oh, yes.
I regard that as a really a wonderful
you too,
book.
Eh?
It's
well,
the
in
most
fact, it's,
wonderful
it's,
book.
It's in my preface, I consider
yes.
it a wonderful novel.
And
a wonderfully
behind
written
that, novel. I know this, and this maybe is off the record too, is an immense amount of suffering.
Oh.
So much suffering.
I know, I could tell that.
You in
yeah.
reading it twice, you come across how it's
yeah.
also a statement about the violence against women and children.
Oh, absolutely.
Despite all the exuberance and joy of life.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you interview the author, she's adamant in not writing about the dark side of that.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday, talking to Rita Joel, it's exactly the same. She says, she wants to do something on residential schools.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I'm not going to write about those areas, because she refuses to write about these things. And I think there are quite a few native authors who say, so much has been written of the lament of the Indian, and I'm so sick of it, and there's so many other things. Tom King, for example, the same. And it's interesting. And maybe you find that more in the East than in the West.
Yes.
Or here in the middle,
yeah.
perhaps, too. I found that
mm-hmm.
interesting. And one... No, okay.
Yeah. I was going to say to that, my reaction to that is, yes, I absolutely understand these writers,
mm-hmm.
why they're saying this. I, for example, have refused to write my autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Like in book form,
mm-hmm.
because my life is very dramatic,
mm-hmm.
and it is full of suffering. But it's only my closest friends know, if
mm-hmm.
even they do,
mm-hmm.
the extent of the suffering
mm-hmm.
that is also a part of my life. I have refused to write it because I saw what Canadian society did.
That's a certain voyeurism, right?
With Maria Campbell's book and with Beatrice Colleton's book. And
James Tymon, too, I guess.
And you know, and I have seen this white Canadian social worker types who disguise themselves as writers. they just drool over these books. You know, and maybe I should say some of this off the record too. This I will want to edit. But this is not saying anything about the books. I think they are wonderful books.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
And I think these two women are excellent writers. And they shared so much. And I've just been angered by how they have been exploited by social work types who drool over these books, or even by Harold Cardinal's book, The Unjust Society. And this is a bit of a bone I have to pick with white critics and white response. Those of us, and there are very few of us, and I'm definitely one of them, who have written in a very different style, perhaps more intellectual. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, for example, in Defeathering, I basically fight with wit and velvet gloves, and sometimes I wish I hadn't. I should have just taken the gloves off. And there's poetry to come yet that does take the gloves off, believe me. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to, because I saw how the other books were being responded to, and yet what I have suffered is basically lack of acknowledgement. And I noticed that any Native writer that does something a bit different than what white people want, we really we become invisible. And that's another huge problem, because, you know, that kind of sets up Native against Native, or it can, it has the potential to do that. But most of all, it's very frustrating, because what I really would like is to be taken seriously as a writer. You know, whether I am an academic writer, or a popular writer, or a critical writer, or a poet, I want to be taken seriously. I am tired of being marginalized. And I want to be engaging in a discussion about what this country is about, what Canadian culture is about. And we are as much a part of this Canadian culture.
Absolutely.
And it's about time people see this, rather than always seeing us as something in the fringes, you know? The Tanner family that hasn't come in yet. But we've been in for a hell of a long time.
Historically, there is no group that is that much Canadian as the Métis.
That's how it's been said, yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, Canadian, if you think of present-day Canada as a state, and Manitoba, of all places, first, right? This is not to discredit the Indian population or the white contributions, but it's the Métis that brought about Canada.
Well, I'll stay away from that as a historian, but but I wanted to finish this thought on literature.
I'm very glad about what you just said.
As much as I myself have consciously chosen, as yet not to divulge my autobiography, which has both immense joy and immense pain. And I'm just doing it in very selectively now, bits and pieces where I find it appropriate. But I still cannot agree totally with what you just told me, what Rita Jo, her position about sharing. I feel like, you know, and I was having this discussion with my childhood best friend. She said she didn't like writing The Circle because it was full of pain. And I said, well, there are definitely some writing in there that I fought not to be included. But I wasn't the editor, so I didn't have the final decision. But I said to my friend, you cannot escape pain. You have to deal with it in some fashion or other. Now there is, again, I go right back to, it's how you deal with things. You know, we don't have to deal with pain like white social workers drooling over it. We can deal with pain like I feel like you can deal with every aspect of life from a place of integrity, from a place of authenticity, and also from a political place, from a political consciousness place. And you can't escape that, you know. Violence against women.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, nobody, no women. I feel like no women on earth have suffered more than Native women from male violence, both from white and Native men. We have to deal with it. We don't have to deal with it from a play, from that, you know, woe, pitiable place. But we have to deal with it politically, and for me, that's where a lot of my passion comes from, is how I approach some of these issues. You have to approach them. I'm not much of an activist or anything, but I know, in terms of consciousness, you cannot be liberated unless you have articulated what that pain is about.
I'm not going to edit this out.
and I really believe very much in articulation, and that articulation doesn't mean we just open our mouths. It means we take the time to understand the places of invasion in our lives, you know, historically, culturally, and most of all, presently, and you know, emotional invasions, psychological invasions,
physical
invasions, absolutely. But we must go for that articulation, and for me, that means going through a process of being decolonized, and therefore understanding what colonization is.
I agree with you.
But I have to say, my position on this has been misunderstood a lot.
I think in no, it's not for me to say.
But I would like to know.
What you said about Rita Joel, I agree with you. This is off the record. For her, it's her religion.
Yes.
It's the church. I think.
Mm-hmm. For us in my community.
And for Ruby, it's probably many things, I don't know. I really like her a lot. I met her twice and we had a wonderful interview. And she's an incredible writer.
I want to make a comment about Rita Joe's poetry,
mm-hmm.
which I like. And in her poetry, especially the earlier stuff,
yeah.
Oh, there are hardly subtle nuances
mm-hmm.
to her suffering.
She said in the first one she still articulated anger, and she decided not to do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in talking to Ruby, she once went to the Penn Conference, I think, and there was an extra group of young women writers from third world nations, the fourth world. And I don't think she ever thought much politically, at least not sort of in terms of colonization, she said. And I listened to them, and we all had the same problems. And why is it? Well, I think I know why it is. She said, it's colonization. There it was. So it's coming back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to say about Ruby Slipperjack's novel. I love that novel.
Yeah.
I've never met her. I've talked to her on the phone. But I feel like she's one of the least... I feel like next to me, maybe she's one of the least acknowledged writers.
She will be.
She
has to be, because that book is so good.
And that book is very good, and there are two reasons why it's good. One is it's one of the first novels that focuses entirely on a Native community, on a Native family. you know, and you get to know these characters,
yeah.
And they're real, and it's not always in reference to white people or white society.
That doesn't.
There is hardly existed. Yeah. There's several allusions.
Yeah, and there's this one trip to the hospital, but
yeah.
And it's a
very balanced novel because that is what life is. It's full of joy and being a child, I mean, wow. But it's also pain, and it takes a long time to understand and comprehend some of these things that go on in one's community. Now, that can be on the record.
Mm-hmm.
Now, off the record, I think for her maybe it'll take a while to be brave enough to spend more time publicly on some of that pain. Or not brave enough, but, you know, everybody goes through a process.
It's that there's two things. One is that, and the other one is sheer time.
Yes.
It's her personal situation does not allow her to write.
Yeah. Yeah, that I understand.
Or hardly at all.
Yeah.
Which is an incredible shame because she said that.
Yeah.
But
I hope she writes more, and I hope
she's got a novel finished.
Yeah.
Well, it's in the computer, and this time it's about a little boy, same age group.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a nice one.
Oh,
I'm looking forward
the world awaits.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like that. I sometimes I feel like I'm wasting my life when I could be writing, because my heart and my head is full of characters,
mm-hmm.
from my community that I, you know,
mm-hmm.
goodness, if Margaret Lawrence can write from a small Manitoba
mm-hmm.
community,
mm-hmm.
so can we.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we were not remote. And that is the biggest thing I think that I want to say, among other things, is that, you know, we were not isolated or remote. We were human beings with our own, you know, our own craziness and our own
mm-hmm.
love of life and,
sure.
You know, our...
Human beings.
Our dancing with the wolves.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, was I getcha? Yeah.
This is, the way I can see it, this is the last interview in all the interviews. And, well, this is perhaps off the record too, but I think I've learned a lot, and I'm still learning while I'm doing these interviews. And regrettably so, some of the most, I think the most important things that I've learned are those things that are off the record. Huh?
Yeah, it's right.
Like if some people say, well, I don't want this on the record, or the personal, the suffering or so, and of course that is respected, but it's been a very good experience. And so if you want to add the final word, go ahead. Or if you want to draw the curriculum for Native Literature in Canada.
Oh, I would love to.
Go ahead.
Actually, I may. Of all the thousand things I'd like to do, I was gonna, you know, after you talked to me
mm.
and said you were doing this book, I turned around and I said to my significant other, Jesus, why didn't I think of that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why?
So are you a bit annoyed that I'm doing it?
I'm not annoyed at you. I'm glad somebody's doing it. Maybe I'm annoyed with myself.
Mm.
But I haven't done it. Of all the thousands
but you
of
can't
things
do
I
everything.
Want to do.
You can't
I
do everything.
Know,
I wasn't
like
going to do it either. I was going to sit down and write my own book, right?
I think what I would like to do, I think what would be fun is to be on film. For all the writers, the major or whatever, well,
mm-hmm.
I don't even know what how
mm-hmm.
one constitutes major or minor.
Mm-hmm.
To have the interviews on film?
But all the Native writers, if we could sit together and have it filmed, and then the gloves are off and all this shit about off the record stuff is off. And we just chat with each other and we let Canadian society watch this. To me, I think that would be great. That'd be one of the things we could do.
And that is something Native writers themselves should initiate.
Well, that is something that some filmmakers also could help out with.
CBC instead of cutting.
Yeah, CBC, NFB,
yeah.
Some enterprising private filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there are just a thousand ways. I feel like Native people, you know, our vastness, our diversity, our different personalities, never mind just plainly our human personalities, the white North American, not to mention white European peoples, haven't even begun to see us. They haven't begun to see us because so much focus is, first of all, on politics, and there's an assumption that everybody agrees with everybody on what's going on in this country about Native politics. And then, almost no matter what we say, how many years does it take for the films of stereotyping to be scratched away so that you really can't see us without that film? As I said in my preface, I have spent years first having to educate the audience before I can even dialogue with them. And that's partly why I'm not a novelist or a voluminous poet or writer yet, because I'm forever having to educate first.
Yeah.
And one gets very tired. Also, one gets very tired talking to oneself. And this is why we need that engagement. That's the other thing, as I started to say in Regina. We need that engagement with Canadian writers, with other Native writers and artists. We need to engage with each other apart from politics.
You mean the Native writers and artists amongst themselves are also
that
mainstream?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Back and forth together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And because I feel like, you know, sometimes I really feel like I'm talking to myself. And so then the last few years, what has happened to me has been actually frightening. I stopped talking. Because by that I mean, I got very discouraged. How can you talk to yourself over and over and over again? You need to get feedback. You need to engage. You know, no great literature is going to come unless we do that.